Today, we're talking about one of the top things on our list of geopolitical risks. Here's what matters. Live from Fort Worth, Texas today, I'm Lauren Goodwin, and this is Market Matters from New York Life Investments. In this podcast, we bring you the best insights from across the New York Life Investments platform because we believe that by sharing perspectives and engaging with you, our listeners, we can all become better investors. Welcome, everyone. It's the week of April 8th, 2024. And today, as I mentioned, I'm in Fort Worth, Texas, here for work, but also to see the solar eclipse. And Julia Herman herself is in New York. She and I will be talking about geopolitics today, specifically the U.S.-China relationship. We're markets people. And so normally when you hear us talk about China, we're discussing the Chinese economy, holistic geopolitical approaches, and how U.S.-based or global investors can access investments in China. I discussed a full range of topics like this with a special guest a few months ago. But today, we're looking at a unique angle of this relationship, access. How much access the US and China are giving each other to each other's tech, resources, industry, and even each other's citizens. And we're doing so today because there's been a confluence of news flow in matters that are distinct, but all come back to this same fundamental geopolitical question of how countries are managing the level of access they provide to other countries. Now, there are lots of implications here, not only for the US-China relationship, but also for the other countries that are caught in the middle.
So what you're saying is we get to talk about TikTok.
We do get to talk about TikTok.
So here's the thing. We hear a lot about bilateral and multilateral trade agreements, defense agreements, international organizations like the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, because the world has headed towards a direction of more cooperation and more global access over time. Restricting that access is therefore a powerful tool in areas of geopolitical tension. So I want to cover both sides of this access question, as in, let's talk about China's access to the U.S., and also U.S. access to China. So let's start with the first. Other than TikTok, what are other examples of the news flow you mentioned relating to this question of how much access China has to the U.S. people, markets, business?
The other key example area, if you will, relates to computer chips or semiconductors.
Yes, that's perfect. So TikTok, semiconductors, let's start with TikTok. In March, the House passed a bill that would force a sale of TikTok by its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, or implement a ban of the app in the United States. The bill is currently sitting in an early committee negotiation in the Senate. So, Julia, does this bill really relate to geopolitics in your view, or is it more noise?
It's both. You may remember the great 2023 Chinese balloon incident.
I do. But for our listeners who don't, this was an event about a year ago in which a high altitude balloon, which became lovingly known as the Chinese spy balloon in memes everywhere, flew across North American airspace and was eventually shot down by the U.S. Air Force off the coast of South Carolina.
Right. So now TikTok has sort of become the new Chinese spy balloon, a place to focus attention on the broader subject of data access and surveillance from any country, really, into the U.S. Now, both the House and Senate have received intelligence briefings on TikTok as the bill was moving through the House. So, Lauren, maybe if you and I had been in on those, we could say with full confidence exactly how relevant the app is to national security. But we weren't. So the idea that Chinese authorities could potentially access information of TikTok's users, you know, that idea isn't new, and a potential ban of the app was discussed years ago.
That's true. And the bill passed very quickly once it was introduced. So why is there a rush and why is it back in the news now?
Right. So TikTok's leadership galvanized their user base to lobby against this bill when it was in the House. And it's been reported in a few places that the effectiveness of those efforts to galvanize the user base, just how quickly and overwhelmingly TikTok users, including some minors, responded to that lobbying call,
You know, apparently that felt to many House members like the more immediate national security risk, more so than, you know, potential access of the app to the information of users. Now, the level of influence that this app has over the youths, as we might call them, ironically, to the intent of that lobbying push against the bill, that seemed to have resulted in a faster passage of this ban.
Okay, so TikTok as a proxy for consumer and data access is an ongoing debate. The other key area the U.S. is pressuring China is on the tech hardware side. So tell me about that.
There are really two fronts to this pressure. First, 2 weeks ago, the U.S. added to and clarified its restrictions on semiconductor exports to China. Just one example of this is that the government has asked U.S. chip designer NVIDIA to not ship certain chips to certain Chinese entities. Usually these tend to be related to the Chinese military. The government has also asked South Korea to step up its restrictions on their own chip exports to China.
So just answer this for me before we go further. Does the U.S. really export that many chips in the first place?
Yeah, it absolutely does. You know, the semiconductor supply chain is as complex as all get out, but the U.S. does have a solid foothold in market share for the design of advanced processing chips, and it manufactures a large amount of mid-range sophistication chips. On the flip side here, China has better volume advantage on lower-end chips.
These seem like pretty holistic restrictions then. So what's the other side of how the U.S. is trying to restrict China's access to tech hardware?
This is where some new news flow comes into play. As of late last week, multiple sources, including Reuters, were reporting that the U.S. is planning to pressure the manufacturing side of chip production. There is a Dutch company called ASML that has a near monopoly over what's called lithography. They're the machines that do light-based etching of chips. So it's a critical step in almost every chip manufacturing process.
And the U.S. wants ASML to stop selling those machines to China?
You know, I don't even think the U.S. might have that level of leverage over ASML, given that it did over 6 billion euros worth, or about 30% of its sales, to China last year alone. Instead, what the U.S. seems to want to do is to pressure ASML into stopping its servicing, its maintenance, on certain types of machines that it's already sold to China. So it's a pretty convoluted way to restrict China's semiconductor manufacturing ability. But China does have plenty of capacity to produce its own chips. So simply restricting exports of some chips to China doesn't seem to do very much. It seems like the U.S. has determined that they need to go over the manufacturing process itself.
The natural next question here is, let's cover the other side of the relationship, the access that China grants the U.S. to its markets. What leverage does China have in that sense?
Plenty. And that's an understatement. China has this underrated but critical leverage here, at least in my opinion, in raw materials. China controls massive market share, often over 50% or more, of the mining and or processing of key minerals. And this includes the lifeblood of all tech, silicone. But this also pertains to other minerals that are used in renewable energy, electric vehicles, batteries, and even nuclear capacity.
And China has made the use of this dominant minerals position in the past, right?
Yes, it has. China has banned not only the export of rare earths minerals at various times, but at the end of last year, it also banned the technology for refining and processing rare earths. So this would be rather similar to that ASML restriction, where the U.S. is trying to restrict Chinese access to the manufacturing side of things. Last October, China also restricted the export of key metals that are used in batteries. And batteries are a key industry that the Chinese government has championed for itself to be a major global leader in. And it has pretty solid competitive advantage there.
It's so interesting because the stakes seem, and actually they are, just quite high here, with both countries able to put a major dent, not just in bilateral tech production capabilities, the capabilities that they use together or share, but also global or multilateral tech supply chains. And
being tough on China from a U.S. perspective, and as we've seen, that can take many forms, it's one of the rare areas of bipartisan cooperation in the U.S. Congress, suggesting that that stance of tough on China isn't likely to change as a result of the U.S. election. So if that's the case, how do you think about the risks as both of these countries, the U.S. and China, are walking side by side down this path towards tech excellence, the new economy, but also in competition with one another?
Yeah, it's a great point. I like how you pointed out that both countries are working toward their own versions of tech excellence. And at times that can come at the cost of, you know, global competition. They both have a lot of leverage here. Our team's opinion is that there's going to be significantly more cooperation and innovation within this bilateral tech relationship than a lot of people and investors currently talk about or expect. The reason for this is because there's only so far that tech-based restrictions can go before costs, from iPhones to AI processing costs, become really prohibitive for both countries. For the past several years, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, Lauren. Many countries have been prioritizing national self-sufficiency in key supply chains over priorities like efficiency and cost savings. But I think that there's a line here between, you know, healthy supply chain diversification and just a sheer wall of cost that would be required to truly siloize something as big as tech hardware and capabilities within each country.
And when Julia says sheer wall of cost, she doesn't mean, oh, it's high. She means it may be impossible. It's just so expensive and it requires so much capability and ingenuity. Ongoing developments like the AI boom are likely to add even more nuance to this relationship, if we're being realistic. But we know that necessity is the mother of innovation, and there's a certain necessity to rethink this relationship. So it may actually be a constructive outlook for the global tech industry and for bilateral relationship that this leverage that each country has over one another and over the global system will result or require innovation. That brings us to our portfolio pause, a segment of the program where we share an investment idea. If you're a regular listener, you're likely familiar with the asset class level implications of the themes that we've discussed today. Things like digital infrastructure, both in the US and globally, the need for that infrastructure to fuel some of the trends we've been describing, and also hedged international exposure. So today, let's talk a little more about the investment philosophy and approach.
Geopolitical risk is a particularly difficult thing to specifically incorporate into portfolios, because risks from that U.S.-China tech relationship to what the Russian military might do next are these pie-in-the-sky possibilities right up until the moment that they aren't.
We always say that timing the market is really difficult, also involves a little bit of luck usually. And as a result, it's not likely to be a winning strategy for many investors, especially over the long term. And it's almost impossible, even for professionals and geopolitical strategists, to time when geopolitical risks come to fruition, or even when risks might become more visible in the market, creating volatility. You think about, you know, any example of a major geopolitical risk, you almost always know it could be a risk, but when will it happen? What will be the trigger? That's the hard part. So geopolitics is one of the dozens of reasons why investors fall back on mainstay principles like diversification, investing as early as possible to ensure a long-term time horizon, and risk and goal management.
But beyond these mainstays, let us level with you. There are some risks that investors simply cannot position around for a variety of reasons. Reason number one is timeline, or the speed of impact of geopolitical risks on the market. The U.S.-China tech relationship we discussed today might take the form of gradual shifts in pricing and supply along the entire tech supply chain. And this would be gradually incorporated into equity valuations and corporate debt issuance and pricing. It doesn't necessarily require its own set of positioning. Reason number two affecting how geopolitics sometimes can't be positioned around is the potential for those true black swans, which we've also talked about on past episodes, the true shocks. While tech tensions we discussed today are broadly understood by many investors, adjusting to a shock can look different. A military-based shock or a sudden change in national policy can create market impacts that are too sudden and too broad-based for most investors to be able to take a stand.
So then, taking these principles that Julia is describing, allocating along these lines and the potential risks investors might see depends entirely on those mainstay principles. How tactical is an investor willing and able to be in their portfolio? And what is their relative risk tolerance or risk aversion? Coming up next, our team has an incredibly exciting launch of new resources, our new Outlook series called Market Pulse. We'll have a two-part episode for you answering questions like, where are we in the economic cycle now? What long-term themes, in addition to geopolitics, do we find most influential in portfolios today? And of course, we'll share our top conviction investment ideas, both asset classes and portfolio construction approaches. We are so excited to share this with you. But that's it for today. We'll be back next week for more Market Matters. In the meantime, please remember to give us a like, follow, or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a question or topic of interest, reach out to us on LinkedIn. You can follow our views and get a sneak peek at MacroPulse at newyorklifeinvestments.com/global-markets. Until then, I'm Lauren Goodwin here with the fabulous Julia Herman, and we will see you next time. All investments are subject to market risk and will fluctuate in value. Diversification cannot assure a profit or protect against loss in a declining market. The opinions expressed are those of the Global Market Strategy Team of New York Life Investment Management, LLC, and not necessarily those of other investment boutiques affiliated with New York Life Investments. This information should not be relied upon by the reader as research or investment advice regarding any strategy, and there's no guarantee that any strategies discussed will be effective. New York Life Investments is both a service mark and the common trade name of certain investment advisors affiliated with the New York Life Insurance Company, New York, New York, 10010.